This is Freemasonry Today, issue number 55 for autumn 2021. FMT is the official journal of the United Grand Lodge of England. The editor is Donna Hardy, and the editorial panel is Michelle Warvel, Sean Butler, Guy Roberts, Barry Hughes, and Julian Perry, the culture editor. It is published by Sunday at 207 Union Street, London, SE10LN, on the web at www.wearesunday.com for the United Grand Lodge of England at Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ. You can contact for Masonic inquiries editor at freemasonrytoday.com or call 020 7831 9811. The website for that is www.ugle.org.uk. In this audio version, we've included all the main articles in the order in which they appear in the printed magazine. We've not included any of the advertising material. Now, the table of contents. The welcome from the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E, Dr. David Staples, welcomes you to the autumn issue. Out and about, news and views from the provinces. Step It Up, a group of universities' scheme lodges, walked 2,021 miles for charity in 2021. Warmest of welcomes, Charles Hopkinson Woolley on creating harmony in a lodge. Cheers to that, unveiling the new cafe, bar and meeting spot in Freemasons Hall. Fortitude on the front line, Dr. David Staples raises the flag for NHS Social Care and Frontline Workers Day. The interview is with Sir Paul Williams, this time introducing the new chairman of the Masonic Charitable Foundation. A daily advancement, the Museum of Freemasonry digitally preserving the museum's rich collection for the future. And QC Writes, Dr. Rick Berman on Philip, Duke of Wharton. The Royal Arch section. Historic links explained, Tony Harvey on A Brotherly Union. The Grand Lodge section has quarterly communication, Pro Grand Master Peter Lowndes. The Members Pathway, your strategy for attracting members and growing lodges. And Monmouthshire to Madras, how provinces and districts can share. Then we have the culture section, book reviews and crossword, and in the community, charity and the craft, how the MCF and Freemasons nationwide are providing a much-needed lifeline. And then under fraternal world, home and abroad, UGLE lodges around the world. And finally in this audio version, the letters page.
On page 3. From the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E. Recently, brethren and companions, I have felt a great appreciation for our refreshingly cool stone corridors here at Freemasons Hall. They have been a welcome respite from the late summer sun, and indeed from the bustling crowds who have flocked back to the city centre. Our beautiful, historic building has felt even more alive because we have started, once again, to accept greater numbers of members and visitors. The Museum of Freemasonry, as well as the newly refurbished award-winning shop, have been drawing in crowds more eager than ever to do something in the real world, rather than via a pixelated facsimile. We have also welcomed back members for lodge and chapter meetings. One might think that we are well on the way to a pre-pandemic normality, but I am keen to remind you of all we have learned and all we have done during the past year and a half as we achieve the longed-for reopening. I find myself thinking about the nature of spaces, how we inhabit them, and how our relationship with space has changed. The pandemic began and continues with warnings to keep our distance from one another. Suddenly, the need for space made intimacy a commodity, and the familiarity of greeting our loved ones with a hug was lost to us all. Space is a concept that is strangely linked to our sense of self. We talk about looking for our place in the world, and when it all gets too much, we need space to think. So, naturally, 18 months of having our space dictated to us by rules of social distancing has been somewhat disconcerting for us all. Many spaces have been reimagined during this time. That bedroom upstairs that had been dormant for far too long was reinvented as an office, a school, and perhaps a Masonic hall. Gardens and green spaces became a haven for relaxation and exercise when nowhere else was open to us. What this has shown is that we can control our small space in the world and adapt it in order to help us face whatever challenges lie ahead. I have been exceptionally impressed by the way Brethren and Companions have adapted and continued to support one another throughout the pandemic. With online meetings, those who may have lost their connection to Lodge and/or Chapter have had the opportunity to reconnect with old friends. Strangely, the space within our lodges, though virtual, feels bigger than ever. Here at Freemasons Hall, we have not been idle either. Much like you all, we have been looking for ways to innovate and make our space as welcoming and exciting as possible, as we anticipate a return to a full calendar of Masonic events. As I write this, we are putting the finishing touches to our new cafe and bar space, which will soon be open for you all to enjoy. An excellent array of food and drink will be served against the stunning backdrop of 1930s decor, full of original furniture and bespoke detailing in fitting with our Grade 2 listed status. We aim for Freemasons Hall to be a destination of choice for all. The space will be filled with music, courtesy of our soon-to-resume concert evenings. We aim to rekindle the wonder in our current members and tempt new faces in with a friendly and welcoming atmosphere, and perhaps show them a little of what Freemasonry is all about. Therefore, brethren, I urge you to plug your ears to the sirens' calls that seek to lull you into thinking that going back to the way things used to be is good enough. We must spring out of this pandemic, not plod. We have shown ourselves to be capable of transforming the world around us to meet the greatest challenge in a generation. Now we have a unique opportunity to ensure that our lodges and chapters are the spaces their members want them to be. I would urge you to continue your endeavours to make them welcoming spaces for all members, new and old, and, more than that, a place where you have fun. The rulers, board, and I are working hard to support you as we move into this exciting new chapter in Freemasonry's long and varied history. Dr. David Staples, Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E.
We now begin the Out and About section of the magazine. This is a roundup of what's happening in the world of Freemasonry.
On page 6, Freemasons partner with the D of E Award. More than 30,000 young people with disabilities and special educational needs will be able to take part in the Duke of Edinburgh's award thanks to a grant of £300,000. Freemasons have become a strategic partner of the Duke of Edinburgh's award, D of E, funding a new national program to ensure all young people have access to D of E. The United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, and the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, have teamed up to enable D of E to reach at least 30,000 young people with special educational needs and disabilities, SEND, by 2024. Dr. David Staples, CEO and Grand Secretary of UGLE, said, "Prince Philip was well known for his charity work, having been involved with numerous organisations. At UGLE, we looked for a project that would honour Prince Philip's memory. Helping young people with special educational needs and becoming a strategic partner of the Duke of Edinburgh's award is therefore a great honour for us. Helping the D of E was an easy decision, as Freemasonry's core values are charity, integrity, respect, and friendship. The ambition is to increase the number of centres, such as schools and youth groups, offering D of E to young people with SEND, and to train hundreds of leaders, skilled individuals who can support groups of young people through their D of E journeys. The programme has been designed to make D of E participation possible for students with diverse difficulties and disabilities. It will help them build crucial personal life skills, develop employability expertise, and become more independent. The aim is to offer students the same experiences available to their peers in mainstream education. It's expected that at least 15,000 young people will achieve a D of E award thanks to the programme sponsored by the 200,000-strong UGLE. The impact of achieving a D of E award is remarkable and will be a life-changing experience for young people with physical or learning difficulties, who are often excluded from adventurous activities due to a lack of accessible equipment, facilities, trained support staff, and funding. A key element of the program is to increase the number of specialist leaders by providing bespoke training to adults supervising young people with special needs. The aim is to have 240 more adults trained to support young people with SEND by 2024. The initiative also includes a plan to offer support to new delivery partners that work with young people with SEND to encourage them to offer the D of E. His Royal Highness, the Duke of Edinburgh, who founded the D of E in 1956, was himself a Freemason, having been introduced to Freemasonry in 1952, at the age of 31, by his father-in-law, King George VI. Throughout his life, Prince Philip was associated with some 992 charities, either as president, patron, or honorary member. Caroline Glenn, director of fundraising for the Duke of Edinburgh's award, said, "We're very grateful to the Freemasons for their generous grant, which will give many thousands of young people with disabilities and special educational needs the chance to take part in the D of E and gain its life-changing benefits. This is a wonderful and very practical way to continue Prince Philip's amazing legacy and to spread the benefits of the D of E further than ever." As well as the late Duke of Edinburgh, other members of the royal family are also Freemasons, including His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, who is the longest-serving Grand Master of the UGLE.
And now some short out-and-about articles from the various regions of the country, starting with Essex. Making a difference. A three-year-old boy with cancer is able to get potentially life-saving treatment in Germany thanks to a £30,000 donation by Essex Freemasons. Henry Hall from Great Wakering was diagnosed with brain and spine cancer in February and has undergone many rounds of chemotherapy treatment. Radiotherapy is now the only treatment that can help to save Henry's life, prompting his parents to seek help in raising £60,000 for proton beam therapy, the least damaging form of treatment, but one that is not available on the NHS. Trustees of the Essex Freemasons Community Fund saw the story about Henry in the local Evening Echo and generously donated the remaining £30,000 needed. Henry's mum, Louise, said, "It's taken a huge weight off our minds because we can concentrate on what we need to do to take care of Henry and our family rather than worrying about how we're going to afford the treatment. I want to thank everyone for helping us to raise this money and for holding Henry in their hearts." Essex Deputy Provincial Grand Master in Charge, Paul Reeves, presented Henry and his family with the cheque. He said, "I'm pleased we have been able to have the funds to make a difference to his life."
Number 2. Devonshire. Rise to the challenge. Devonshire Freemason Mark Ormrod, MBE, has completed a remarkable swimming feat for charity. Mark has recently been working hard on his latest fundraising challenge as he continues to raise money for veterans charity REORG. He's just completed a 0.6-mile open water event in Plymouth, swimming to Drake's Island and back. In completing this challenge, he hopes his fundraising efforts for REORG will take him to more than £400,000. Mark is a member of Royal Marines Lodge No. 9528 and Unity Chapter No. 1247. You can follow his story at markormrod.com, which includes links to Mark's Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and to REORG. In completing this latest challenge, Mark sends thanks to his coach Ben, the three boys' swim team, and to everyone who has supported him in preparing and completing these challenges.
Number 3. West Lancashire. Up to speed. Northwest Blood Bikes took delivery of a new BMW RT1250 motorcycle after Terry Derbyshire, charity steward of Carnarvon Lodge No. 2376, organised a fundraiser with lodges around Leyland and Chorley. The bike was delivered in June following fundraising efforts that raised £20,000 over an 18-month period. Terry, a keen biker himself, takes up the story. As an avid motorcyclist, I feel safety in riding is paramount. I decided to train with SLAM, or SLAM, South Lancs Advanced Motorcyclists, to become an advanced motorcyclist incorporating high standards of safety. Through SLAM, I became aware that many of the members are blood bikers. A requirement of riding a liveried blood bike is that you must have passed the advanced motorcycling test, which prompted the idea of raising funds to purchase a blood bike. As charity steward of Carnarvon Lodge, I was already looking at various charities, and as a biker, I saw firsthand how the NHS worked together with volunteers in the event of an accident, including the air ambulance and the blood bikes. The goal was to raise money to buy a blood bike by involving all of the Leyland lodges in fundraising and using this to promote the charitable side of Freemasonry. The Leyland lodges have donated, as well as a number of other lodges. The West Lancashire Freemasons Charity also made a contribution, along with some personal donations. It's an incredible feat that aim to buy a blood bike has been achieved in so short a space of time.
Number 4. Derbyshire. Dreams made true. Members of the Derbyshire Freemasons Motorcycle Lodge joined other riders from biker organisation Widow's Sons to make a dream come true for 16-year-old Matty Hatton, a young man from Mount Sorrel who is undergoing palliative care for relapsed brain tumours. Matty is obsessed with motorbikes, something that came to the attention of Freemason bikers who, along with other riders, had previously turned up at his home on their bikes, in their hundreds, as a surprise. On the 3rd of July, the Widow's Sons surprised Matty again, this time with a helicopter trip for him and his family. The cost of the trip was collected from various lodges as well as chapters of the Widow's Sons on the day. One member then had the idea to use the local school field to give Matty an extra boost by spelling out his name with motorcycles to be seen from the air. The invitation went out across the country and Widow's Sons riders came from far and wide. Flying over, Matty managed to take a few snaps with his own camera but said, "I was too busy looking at everything to concentrate on taking pictures." The day was a complete success. Everybody who took part, including those behind the scenes, had a fantastic time helping to create special memories for Matty.
5. South Wales. Play it forward. Thousands of young patients at the Noah's Ark Children's Hospital for Wales in Cardiff will continue to receive support from a vital play service 7 days a week thanks to a grant of £50,000 from South Wales Freemasons. The play specialist team at Wales' only children's hospital supports around 3,700 young people each month. Through structured and age-appropriate play, they help prepare young patients for treatment, reduce anxiety, tackle phobias, and support rehabilitation. The team also works with younger children to ensure that they continue to reach developmental milestones, particularly important during long hospital stays. Holly San Miguel's son Isaac was born with a hole in his heart. He spent a month in the hospital before undergoing a successful operation. He returns every year for a full checkup. Holly said, "Having a child in hospital is bad enough, but knowing that they can't play or enjoy the things they should be, especially at such vital developmental stages, makes it particularly tough as a parent. When Isaac was in hospital, he was hooked up to machines, which meant he wasn't able to go to the playroom. So having a play specialist at hand to interact and bring things to him was really important. It made the experience far more pleasurable for him, but also helped me to relax by seeing him happy."
Number 6. Warwickshire. Point of Honour. The senior warden of Boldmere Lodge in Warwickshire, Nigel Dugmore, has been honoured with the British Empire Medal in the Queen's Birthday Honours List. The award specifically recognised the setting up of a team of volunteers to support shielding and vulnerable patients, as well as ensuring the delivery of more than 3,000 prescriptions a week. Nigel, a Telford and Wrekin Borough councillor, helped by getting patients shopping while his pharmacy has remained open 7 days a week. He was keen to emphasise that this is recognition of a real team effort. The worshipful master of Boldmere Lodge, Graham Holt, said, "I am delighted that Nigel's professional dedication and community involvement have been recognised with this prestigious award. It not only reflects highly on him,
but also on his wife Lisa and their family and, of course, on his supportive staff at the Donington Community Service Pharmacy. I look forward with much anticipation to installing him in October as my successor as Worshipful Master of Boldmere Lodge.
Number 7. Somerset. Duty of care. Somerset Freemasons have donated £17,500 to the Young Carers Development Trust. The charity tackles the lack of opportunity experienced by many young carers, particularly during the pandemic. More than 20,000 unpaid UK carers are receiving support online. The project is providing 870 young carers with respite through activities and breaks, while 760 are being provided with essential items and life skills. Elsewhere, almost 100 schools are getting help to support hidden young carers. In total, more than 1,800 young carers are receiving advice and support. Dr. David Staples, Chief Executive Officer and Grand Secretary of UGLE, said, "With donations we are making across the country, we're helping with training, counselling, support and mental and physical health, as well as activities to reduce stress. We want to recognise the enormous contribution carers make to families and communities throughout the UK. They do their best because they want to make a difference and care deeply for their family members."
Number 8. Hampshire and Isle of Wight. Reach out and touch. Through the MCF, the Provincial Grand Lodge of Hampshire and Isle of Wight has awarded a grant of £30,000 to Living Paintings, enabling children to enjoy a free and expanding library of their touch-to-see books. Manufactured and published by the charity, more than 200 titles are available, with Braille and 3D images, to help partially sighted and blind children to read and learn. APGM Peter Vosser and PCO Roger Maber met partially sighted Monty with his family and Camilla Oldland, the CEO of Living Paintings, to find out more about the work they do.
Number 9. North Wales. Forest Fun. Thanks to a £150,000 grant from the Freemasons, charity Contact has been able to provide disabled children and their families with a free forest school experience that lets them have fun, builds confidence and reduces isolation. Contact hosts events in the Hawarden Estate, North Wales, and across the West Midlands and Wales. Families got to enjoy a mud kitchen, mini beast hunt, building hammocks, cooking marshmallows and popcorn on the campfire, and den building. It's one of a host of exciting events being planned with something to suit all interests, including interactive theatre performances, stories workshops, and sports days. It was one of the first live events after more than a year of restrictions, and parents and children alike were overjoyed to meet up with other families. Lizzie Salter, Contact's Better Together events manager, said, "We're really grateful to North Wales Freemasons for their generous grant. Families with disabled children can feel isolated and alone because they don't know anyone else in their situation. And the COVID-19 pandemic has magnified those feelings. Our Better Together events are the perfect tonic. They're not only an opportunity for families to enjoy fun, shared experiences, they also boost confidence and help them make friends and support networks."
Number 10. Herefordshire. Wheel of Fortune. In May 2019, Freemasons from East Nor Lodge, number 751, in Ledbury, Herefordshire, rode their bicycles along the 150-mile coast-to-coast route from Whitehaven to Sunderland. Their efforts were rewarded by raising more than £6,000 for RoboCap, Breast Cancer Haven, and MCF's charities affiliated charities. In June, following a year off, the lure of Lycra was too much, and members of East Nor Lodge set out on their bikes, including a Brompton and a Tandem, for a 100-mile ride around the county. This year's route took them from Ledbury to Bromyard, and then on to Leominster, Kington, and Hay-on-Wye. Following an overnight rest, the cyclists continued to Hereford and Ross-on-Wye before returning to Ledbury. Money raised through the event was divided equally between three local Ledbury charities.
Number 11. Yorkshire West Riding. Rest easy. Parents of children undergoing heart surgery at Leeds General Infirmary will be able to sleep on site in comfort, thanks to a significant donation from the region's Freemasons. The Children's Heart Surgery Fund has been given £29,148 to refurbish and furnish 7 family accommodation rooms within the Leeds Congenital Heart Unit. Around 17,000 babies, children and adults with congenital heart disease are treated as outpatients by the Leeds Congenital Heart Unit every year. Many are admitted to the hospital for surgery, and family accommodation is available to parents and siblings so they can stay close to patients during what is a traumatic time for all. The grant from the Freemasons Province of Yorkshire West Ridings Provincial Grand Masters Fund will see all the rooms are brought to a warm and welcoming standard. The refurbishment extends to a full redecoration, new carpets, lighting and blinds, along with new beds, seating and wash sinks. The rooms provide a secure space for parents and meet not only their physical needs, but take into consideration their emotional well-being and mental health too. The Children's Heart Surgery Fund was one of 5 major grants totalling £111,000 given to good causes across its geographical region, which stretches from Sheffield in the south to Ripon in the north and Goole in the east to Waddington in the west. While major grants from this fund, ranging from £5,000 upwards, are awarded annually, its minor grants, with a ceiling of £5,000, are awarded quarterly. The Children's Heart Surgery Fund was nominated for the grant by Chevin Lodge in Otley after member Carl Woodyer's granddaughter Bella was born last July with holes in her heart. She spent much of Christmas in the unit located in Leeds General Infirmary after undergoing open heart surgery and faces more operations in the future. Carl said, having first-hand experience of Leeds Congenital Heart Unit and the way the fantastic team there has looked after Bella and her parents, I wanted to do something in return. After learning they were raising funds to upgrade the on-site family accommodation, I asked if Chevin Lodge would apply for a major grant from the Provincial Grandmasters Fund. To say I'm delighted is an understatement. Charity is at the heart of Freemasonry, and this grant will enable many families of children needing heart surgery to stay on site and in comfort. You can find information about the Province of Yorkshire West Riding at www.wrprovince.org.uk.
Number 12. Staffordshire. Serve and protect. Woolsall brothers George and Aldo Bragasi from Polytechnic Lodge No. 2847 in London have generously purchased 35,000 face masks to give away. The brothers own a business in Woolsall and wanted to support those in need in both Staffordshire and London. They gave 17,500 masks to the Salvation Army in London, while the other 17,500 were donated to Staffordshire Freemasons for distribution. Ralph Howarth, representing Staffordshire Freemasons, collected the masks from the brothers in Woolsall and, with the help of several other members, started distributing them throughout Staffordshire. They were delivered to key workers and carers, as well as food banks and 4 homeless shelters. The team delivering the masks in Staffordshire includes Ralph Howarth, the third principal in Staffordshire Royal Arch, Mike Santopietro, assistant provincial grand master, David Thomas, deputy provincial grand master, John Skellen, charity steward for Staffordshire, John Derry, assistant provincial grand master, Robin Stubbs, grand superintendent for Staffordshire, Kevin Parks, past assistant provincial grand master, Tony Coates, almoner for Staffordshire, and Matt Gibbons, provincial secretary for Staffordshire. Selwyn Burton, communications officer for Staffordshire Freemasons, said, "Staffordshire Freemasons would like to thank our friends and brothers George and Aldo Bragasi for their generosity in making such a generous donation to the well-being of people in Staffordshire and London, and to all our members who have helped in the distribution of the face masks."
And finally, number 13, Sussex. On the ball, the Rugby Lodge of Sussex, number 9990, has held its first regular meeting since March 2020. The lodge, which meets at venues in Sussex, met at the Normandy Centre in Horsham, and despite several members, including the prospective initiate, being pinged and unable to attend, it fielded a strong and very capable team on the night. This next section of the magazine is entitled Stories, People, Places, History and More, and includes five stories. University's scheme lodges take on a 2021 mile charity walk, Charles Hopkinson Woolley on welcoming new members, Freemasons Hall unveils its new cafe, bar and meeting spot, Dr. David Staples raising the flag in honour of NHS frontline workers, and new chairman of the MCF, Sir Paul Williams, on shaping its future.
On page 16, Great Strides. In celebration of all Freemasons being able to meet outdoors in real life, a group of universities' scheme lodges walked 2,021 miles in 2021 and raised funds for the Duke of Edinburgh Memorial Fund along the way. Have you ever woken up in the morning and had some strange but wonderful ideas? Well, a few short months ago, a Freemason in Staffordshire did exactly that. His idea? Organise a challenge to walk 2,021 miles in 2021. The Freemason in question is David Thomas, Deputy Provincial Grandmaster of Staffordshire, who could not get the thought out of his mind. So, along with Andrew Mapperson and Peter Hughes, colleagues from University's Lodge of Staffordshire, he decided to put a plan into action. The idea was to involve all of the 85 or so University Scheme lodges. With the resources of the university scheme under the chairmanship of James Hilditch, the plan started to take shape. David's concept was to welcome Freemasonry back to some sort of normality and enjoy fun and fellowship on the way. Approval for the challenge was given by Assistant Grandmaster Sir David Wootton, University's scheme president, and Chairman James Hilditch. The objectives of the challenge were to promote Freemasonry, to promote engagement and fraternity between university scheme lodges, to raise charitable donations through sponsorship during the journey, all donations going to the Duke of Edinburgh Memorial Fund. The challenge relay was to start and finish at Freemasons Hall, London, and to be completed between the planned quarterly communication meetings in June and September. Teams from each scheme lodge carried a replica of the David Kenneth Williamson, DKW, Cup, a trophy normally claimed by one scheme lodge visiting another, from the centre where it meets to the next nearest scheme lodge. The superb replica cup was made by Warwickshire Freemason David Leask and passed in turn until the centres of all scheme lodges in England and Wales had been visited, a distance of 2,021 miles. The biggest challenge was how to organise an event of this magnitude in a short space of time under COVID-19 restrictions. It has often been said that if you want a job done well, then give it to a busy man. In this case, it was not just one busy man, but several. So, while the efforts of the three-man organising committee were important, the contribution of all the university's scheme coordinators was invaluable. Just after 1 p.m. on the 9th of June, the first group of walkers left UGLE, led by university's scheme past chairman Julian Soper and his two faithful dogs. Since that time, the Cup has traversed provinces along the south coast to Cornwall and back to Bristol. It has been through Wales, the northwest, and onwards clockwise around the country. To date, several hundred Freemasons and about 80 different lodges have taken part. Members of both female Grand Lodges also joined in to ensure all Freemasonry is represented. We have even seen a challenge to an inter-province cricket match. There has been a wonderful mixture of new and young Freemasons, as well as more senior members involved, including many provincial grandmasters and provincial officers. The general mood of the event is reflected by the comments of one entered apprentice Freemason, Matt Thomas from Cheshire, who said, "I was initiated 3 weeks before the first lockdown, but the challenge has kept me in touch, and I have made new friends and learned more about Freemasonry, despite no formal meetings in that time. I can't wait to resume official meetings again." Lead walker from Liverpool University, Liam Hayward, said, "It was a lot of fun, a good laugh, and excellent to catch up with so many people we hadn't seen in a while." Head of West Wales Freemasons, James Ross, who took part in the leg from Aberystwyth, said, St. Padan Lodge has gone from strength to strength since joining the university scheme in 2018, and I am delighted to be here in Aberystwyth to raise money for the Duke of Edinburgh's Memorial Fund. All three of my children have been involved in the D of E scheme and have benefited from taking part in the education, challenges, and volunteering. I would like to thank Steve Fern and the team at St. Padan Lodge for making the university scheme such a success at Aberystwyth University. Tobias Morgan, a Master Mason from University's Lodge of Staffordshire, took part in the walk from Bristol to Chepstow and captured the challenge perfectly. After nearly a year in lockdowns, it was great to get out and have some normality and meet new friends. We have organised other events on the back of the challenge. The relay continued on its course, ending on the 8th of September, and the cup was presented back to the scheme chairman at the September quarterly communication meeting of Grand Lodge at Freemasons Hall, London. Overall, the event has been a great example of Freemasons working together, and the results show it to be an outstanding success. If you wish to support the 2021 challenge and contribute to this worthwhile cause, please visit the Just Giving page, which can be found on Facebook on the university's scheme page. This article is accompanied by a number of photographs from different legs of the walk, with images of walkers from West Kent, North Wales, South Wales, Bristol, Sussex, Cheshire, Durham, and Portsmouth.
Page 20 has an article called Imperfect Harmony. Ritual shouldn't spoil the fun of Freemasonry. Instead, let's be encouraging and welcoming, says Grand Director of Ceremonies Charles Hopkinson Woolley. As a member of five craft lodges and two Royal Arch chapters, along with two Rose de Croix chapters and a Mark Lodge, I'm often asked why I'm a member of so many Masonic units. I invariably reply that it's because I enjoy my Freemasonry so much. But I rarely stop to think about what exactly it is that gives me so much pleasure. When I try to analyse it, it's clear that there are many components. Among them are the sense of tradition, the pleasure of a good ceremony or well-delivered ritual, the joy in seeing old friends and making new ones, the satisfaction derived from our charitable activities, and the conviviality of a good meal. However, it's clear that underpinning all of this is the importance of a sense of being among friends and of enjoying a pervading atmosphere of goodwill and togetherness, whether in the lodge room or afterwards. It is this sense of harmony that is the foundation of a happy lodge. Its presence will help to ensure that a lodge is well attended and growing, while its absence, in the long term, will lead to dwindling attendance and a shrinking membership. The importance of this harmony isn't immediately apparent to a newly initiated Freemason. There is so much for him to take in that his early progress in Freemasonry is probably driven by curiosity and the encouragement of his proposer and seconder. However, it is specifically referred to by the worshipful master in the first degree ceremony, when it's drawn to the attention of the newly made Freemason immediately after he has been invested with his apron. The worshipful master warns the initiate that he should never put on this badge if he is about to visit a lodge in which there is a brother with whom he is at variance, lest the harmony of the lodge be disturbed. This seemingly minor caution, so little remarked upon, perhaps because it's followed shortly after by that magnificent piece of Masonic prose, The Charge After Initiation, is one that we neglect at our peril. We must ensure that our meetings are harmonious and that we avoid dissent between brethren with differing views and priorities, not just when we visit other lodges, but also in our own. Active membership of the craft is first and foremost a hobby. Time spent in Freemasonry is time away from our families and our work, and we may end up spending considerable sums on dress and regalia, annual memberships, travel, charitable donations and dining. If a member doesn't enjoy his lodge or chapter meetings, he will lose interest in attending, however strong his sense of duty. We must therefore think carefully about every element of our meetings to ensure that they enhance rather than detract from enjoyment. Is the time of the meeting convenient for the members? Is the stipulated dress code popular? Are brethren encouraged, but not pressurised, to attend a lodge of rehearsal? Are the meetings well run and efficient? And is the quality of the dining arrangements and meeting venue appropriate? One of the many strengths of Freemasonry is the diversity of its lodges and membership, so each of these aspects should be viewed in the context of the lodge in question and not be aligned with some imaginary template. Younger working Freemasons generally benefit from meeting times that allow them to leave their jobs at an acceptable time, often prefer more formal dress codes and enjoy high-quality dining, while older Freemasons might prefer earlier meeting times and may be more concerned about the cost of dining. A lodge whose brethren are mainly retired might wish to organise a regular lodge of rehearsal so that the members can enjoy a drink or a meal together afterwards, while the director of ceremonies of a lodge with a young membership might find it more productive to arrange evening or weekend video calls to rehearse those taking part in the ceremony and give them confidence and direction. Just as important as all of these factors is an acceptance that the arrangements can never be perfect for every member of the lodge, and that we must avoid intolerance when this is the case. For example, there should be no stigma attached to a late arrival. Better that the member in question feels confident that he will be warmly welcomed, even if he has missed part of the ceremony, than that he be too embarrassed to come at all if unavoidably delayed. Most of these matters will be decided by a lodge committee, but there is one facet of Freemasonry that can be a considerable source of friction or variance between members and clearly falls within the responsibilities of the director of ceremonies, namely the ritual. If we genuinely love our Freemasonry, we must be careful to encourage our brothers in this regard and not to do anything that might unwittingly cause offence or unhappiness, however well-intentioned. In far too many lodges, I have seen a senior, experienced Freemason correct a more junior brother in the midst of a piece of ritual. Whenever I witness this, my heart sinks, as all too often the brother who interrupts is just trying to show off his own knowledge. In the meantime, the brother who has been corrected may have just lost the thread of the ritual and will, in many cases, suffer embarrassment. Even worse, I have witnessed a visiting officer cross the floor of a lodge to remonstrate with the inner guard for a supposed error, when in fact the brother in question had done nothing wrong. How discouraging it must have been for the inner guard, and what a dreadful example was set by a senior Freemason to all those present. A better approach would have been for the visiting officer to have a quiet chat afterwards with the director of ceremonies, who could then have decided what action, if any, to take. In a well-run lodge, the only prompts should come from the immediate past master or another nominee for the worshipful master or from the director of ceremonies for everyone else. Even then, as long as the sense of the ritual is clear to the candidate, an interruption is more likely to detract from his experience than to enhance it, and should only be made when a prompt is clearly required. The only time when accuracy is more than simply desirable is for obligations, and even then a correction is only essential if the meaning of the words has been compromised. There are many different forms of ritual recognised by UGLE, and all are equally valid, so there's no need whatsoever to insist upon perfection. The fact that the Emulation Lodge of Improvement awards silver matchboxes to those who deliver a word-perfect ceremony shows just how difficult and highly prized it is. While always aiming high, most of us should be content to remember that the experience of the candidate is paramount and that imperfect ritual that is delivered with feeling and meaning is infinitely preferable to complete accuracy delivered in a relentless monotone. What matters is that the brother has made an effort to learn the ritual. Reading from the book should be avoided at all costs, as it means that there will be no eye contact with the candidate, essential for a meaningful ceremony, while the lack of effort it betrays demonstrates an absence of respect, either for the candidate or for the other members of the lodge. Learning the ritual is part of the shared experience that helps to bond the members of the craft together, so it's important always to do one's best when agreeing to take on work. For a new Freemason, the challenges of getting the ritual and ceremonial aspects right are probably the most nerve-wracking aspects of Freemasonry, and even relatively experienced brothers may experience a degree of stage fright or a senior moment from time to time. When a less experienced member of the lodge is playing a part in the ceremony, greet his delivery with warm smiles to put him at ease. Pay close attention and follow it with encouraging remarks and congratulations, regardless of whether or not it was spot on. That way, he'll be more willing to continue up the ladder or to take on additional work, while others witnessing this may be more prepared to contribute in future. While some enjoy the limelight and relish the mental challenge of learning the ceremonies by heart, others find the experience incredibly challenging. The director of ceremonies should therefore ensure that each officer with a part in the ceremony is given the chance to say how much work he feels comfortable to take on. In the case of the worshipful master, much of the work can be split up into convenient sections and may be delegated either to past masters or, in the case of the working tools, to more junior brethren. Difficulty with learning ritual by heart should not be a barrier to passage through the chair. As long as he can open and close the lodge, a brother who contributes significantly to other aspects of the lodge should be given the chance to be installed as worshipful master, with the rest of the work allocated to others during his year. Over the past year, we've all learnt what's meant by an R number in relation to the transmission of viruses, an R number greater than one signifying that each person carrying the virus is, on average, infecting more than one new victim. We ought to be mindful of our own R number when it comes to the craft, and should strive to ensure we each introduce at least one more good candidate during our period of membership. However, it's even more important that we do not end up with negative Masonic R number by putting off our brethren through our own actions. Ask yourself, after each meeting, whether it was a better meeting for your attendance or a worse one. The Redman test, so named because I was taught it by VW bro Graham Redman. Remember that a smile of encouragement to a brother new to ritual is more likely to lead to success and satisfaction than an interruption. That a single well done after a good delivery is worth 100 demonstrations of your own proficiency. And that the enjoyment of all is far more important than perfect accuracy in the ritual. And this article is accompanied by 2 full-page photographs of the gentleman himself, Charles Hopkinson Woolley.
On page 24, City Social. Head of Trading at UGLE, Perry Bushell, raises the curtain on the stunning new cafe and bar at Freemasons Hall. For many years, the only way visitors could get a hot drink at Freemasons Hall was if they were able to locate and then operate a coffee machine tucked away in one of the first floor offices. That has now changed with the opening of a new cafe and bar for members and the general public on the site of the old shop. The cafe opened in July, selling a range of gourmet sandwiches, cakes, teas and coffees from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m, while across the room a licensed bar serves 2 draft beers, bottled beer, wines and spirits from 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. for members and public alike. It's all part and parcel of the plan to open up the building and Freemasonry in general, says Perry Bushell, head of trading. We want to demonstrate that we have nothing to hide here. The cafe will be a great place for members and visitors. We will start off fairly modestly with sandwiches, cakes, tea and coffee, and on the Masonic dining side we have a bar that serves drinks. We basically want to look after members in a better way. The cafe will have space for 40 to 50 covers, with an option to extend into the neighbouring private dining space should there be sufficient demand. It is being decorated in a relatively informal style, using a mishmash of period tables and chairs gathered from all around the building. That will ensure the space does not have a canteen-like uniform approach, retaining a club feel for the benefit of members who are encouraged to treat the room like a private club that welcomes the general public. The neighbouring bar will open after lunch to attract those attending afternoon meetings, and remain available for those who want a drink before or after evening meetings. These hours might be extended to earlier opening if there is sufficient demand. Similarly, while at first the food on offer will be limited to upmarket cakes and sandwiches, Bushell and his catering team will monitor the initial response and then tweak it all the time, with a view to possibly introducing hot food or salads made on the premises. We might see if we can get a small oven, because you don't need all that much to provide things like croissants and fresh bread, he says. We will definitely have a toaster to make paninis. We don't have a huge amount of space behind the scenes, but we could develop it going forward as we seek to improve the offer. The cafe has been opened partly in response to regular feedback from visitors to the shop and the museum, who have said how much they'd like to be able to sit down and have a cup of tea in the relative peace of Freemasons Hall before heading back into the maelstrom of Covent Garden. Its opening corresponds with the launch of digital tours for Freemasons Hall, which take advantage of the huge interest in the building and Freemasonry from the public, as demonstrated by Open House Weekend, which attracted 9,000 visitors in 2019. These digital tours launched in July and cost £5 a tour, explains Bushell. The visitor gets an electronic tablet and a set of earphones that guides them around, explaining the architecture, the symbolism, and general history. You can hire them in the shop, do the tour, and watch a short film about Freemasonry before handing back the handset to get a discount in the cafe. The new cafe and bar is the latest innovation in UGLE's bid to make Freemasons Hall a more welcoming space. Last year, a new shop opened, adding 60% to the old retail area and selling additional lines in regalia and souvenirs. The shop also created a new range of bespoke gifts related to Freemasonry and Freemasons Hall. It was named Best Shop by the Association of Cultural Enterprises, an organisation that includes prestigious names such as the British Museum, National Gallery, and the Tate. "What a sumptuous-looking treasure box of a shop," said one judge. "Great use of this space with fabulous lighting choices and well-considered visual merchandising. A unique offer for an unusual demographic." Bushell hopes the new cafe will be received just as well, particularly when visitor numbers return to pre-COVID levels. In the meantime, the quieter time can be used to iron out wrinkles and refine the offering to ensure the best possible experience. "We are hoping that during the summer months, the numbers will increase, and the feedback from members is certainly that they are looking forward to coming back," he says. "We will be ready to serve them when they do. We are very optimistic and excited to be opening a new cafe in this unique location in the heart of Covent Garden." This article is accompanied by a collage of photographs showing staff and customers in the cafe at Freemasons Hall, as well as a photograph of a cup of coffee with square and compasses drawn in cocoa powder on the foam.
Page 26 has the next story in this section, Flying the Flag. At 10 a.m. on the 5th of July, the United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, invited its 200,000 members to fly specially designed flags to celebrate a day dedicated to the NHS, social care and all the workers on the front line who saved so many lives during the pandemic. The event was also a chance to remember those workers we have lost. The UGLE is one of the core supporters of the NHS, Social Care and Frontline Workers Day, alongside the Cadet Forces, English Heritage and the Women's Institute. A £5 donation from every flag and a length of bunting made will be equally divided between NHS Charities Together and the National Care Association. Freemasonry for Women and the Order of Women Freemasons also joined the UGLE in this initiative, as Freemasons aimed to set a record for the number of flags raised simultaneously across the country. Freemasonry marked the occasion throughout the day. At 11 a.m, the UGLE headquarters in Great Queen Street raised the flag, while a trumpeter played the last post. At the same time, Freemasons held a moment's silence to remember NHS workers and all those who have died from COVID-19. The day continued with a toast to the NHS at 1 p.m, and a cuppa was raised during afternoon tea at 4 p.m. At 8 p.m, Freemasons joined the country in an evening clap for NHS workers, while church bells rang 73 times, one for every year of the NHS. there was a hashtag time to toast for all NHS workers to close the celebrations at 9 p.m. Nearly 130 lodges and provinces made a commitment to the raising of the flag and other elements of the day. In addition, Northumberland Freemason James Horner hosted a special live streaming show from the Tyne Theatre and Opera House, featuring a compere, comedians, singers, readings, video footage and messages of support to raise money on the day. As part of the commemorations, the Teddies for Loving Care, TLC, scheme, managed by the Freemasons, produced a limited edition of TLC Teddy Nurse badges for the medical staff who use the bears in their day-to-day work. Some 48 provinces across England and Wales took part in the campaign, distributing them to NHS staff. Freemasons have been donating teddy bears to NHS accident and emergency units for 20 years. Almost 3.5 million teddies have been provided to hospitals, minor injuries clinics and other NHS services to comfort young children during times of distress. Many Freemasons also volunteer hundreds of hours each year to manage the scheme, deliver bears to hospitals, campaign to raise funds and increase awareness through events and talks. Pageant master Bruno Peake, OBE, creator of NHS Social Care and Frontline Workers Day, said, "We are delighted that Freemasons, whose members come from all walks of life, are playing such a high profile and active role to start this special day of celebration. It commemorates those within the NHS, social care and on the front line who undertake so much for us all, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, without any thought of their own safety." In addition, Dr. David Staples, CEO and Grand Secretary of the UGLE and a consultant in acute internal medicine at Peterborough Hospital, said, "We're facing the greatest pandemic in living memory, and the NHS has never been so tested in its history. Its staff have been stretched beyond comprehension during the last year, and they deserve our gratitude, our applause, and all the support we can give." Since the start of the pandemic, Freemasons have been supporting the NHS in many ways. So far, they have donated more than £2.5 million to the COVID-19 effort and completed 18.5 million hours of volunteer work. The donation is being used to help with food, personal protective equipment, supplements for hospitals and hospices, funds for NHS workers and ambulances. Freemasons have also offered their lodges as bases to administer the vital vaccinations. In Hertfordshire, for example, Halsey Hall is being used as a vaccination centre, supporting 3 local GP surgeries. It's been operational since the 15th of January, and once fully scaled up, around 1,000 vaccinations will be provided there each day.
On page 30, funding for good. From a graduate trainee in a hospital mortuary to chief executive for NHS Wales, Sir Paul Williams has had a rich career. As new chairman of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, he explains how he's aligning the charity with the values of UGLE. When Sir Paul Williams welcomes visitors to the office of the Masonic Charitable Foundation in the lower ground floor of Freemasons Hall, he describes it as the guts of the building. That's a fittingly corporeal metaphor for Sir Paul, who spent a heavyweight career in health, managing hospitals, NHS trusts, and eventually the entire Welsh NHS. Sir Paul is now chairman of the MCF, having replaced James Newman in May. Previously, he chaired the Royal Masonic Benevolent Institution, RMBI, Care Company, which in the spring of 2020 was in the front line of the COVID-19 pandemic that ravaged the care home sector. The RMBI board acted quickly, with the support of the MCF, to do all it could to protect the residents and staff. Thankfully, the RMBI homes are now in a positive phase of recovery. Sir Paul says the MCF is preparing its response to provide support in a post-pandemic world, both for the membership and the wider community dealing with long COVID, post-viral fatigue, NHS waiting times, mental health, and social inequality. It might be a coincidence that both Sir Paul and Dr. David Staples spent the bulk of their careers in the NHS, but it means that Freemasonry is equipped to face the pandemic-related challenges of the coming years. Sir Paul wants to closer align the MCF's objectives with those of the UGLE. Our big opportunity is to work much more closely with UGLE, he says. We are autonomous in terms of governance, but we need to ensure we have complementary strategies, as there will be so much more we can offer to strengthen the organisation. The MCF springs entirely from the craft and the support of the membership. We want to align as closely as possible without living in each other's pockets and develop a true partnership, as that can only benefit Freemasonry. Cardiff-born Sir Paul started working in hospital administration after finishing his A-levels, completing his first professional qualifications while working at the Welsh Hospital Board. He was fast-tracked onto the NHS graduate scheme, where he rotated through pretty much every job in the hospital. On his very first day on the NHS graduate scheme, Sir Paul, then 21, found himself working in a hospital mortuary in Taunton, assisting on a post-mortem. It was quite a rite of passage, he says. By the age of 23, Sir Paul was taking charge of a 600-bed psychiatric hospital. A stellar career followed, culminating in Sir Paul's appointment as Chief Executive for NHS Wales and Director General of Health and Social Services, a role that made him directly responsible for around 45% of the Welsh Government's budget. If there's one thing that defines Sir Paul's approach to life, it's a thirst for learning. This is something he acquired while completing his first professional qualification, recognising a direct connection between education and work. That has stayed with me all my life, he says. Sir Paul's CV now includes an honorary fellowship, doctorate, and visiting professor from South Wales Universities, past president of the Institute of Health Services Management, and companion of the Chartered Institute of Management. Another influence could be the strong tradition of self-improvement in South Wales, which saw miners operate their own institutes and libraries. I have always supported the underdog, he says, taking the approach that people probably have greater potential than they give themselves credit for. People need opportunities and role models. It's an attitude that helped Sir Paul thrive through at least 9 major reorganisations of the NHS, and then make the step into the civil service as Chief Executive of NHS Wales. And when retirement beckoned in 2012, it meant he found new challenges, joining the board of Natural Resources Wales when it formed as an integration of 3 existing bodies, and then working with charities, including the Royal Voluntary Service and St John Ambulance Cymru, for which he is currently Prior for Wales. Around this time, he was invited to bring his professional expertise to the board of the RMBI. As a seasoned NHS integrator, he could anticipate the challenges presented by the forthcoming formation of the MCF from the 4 Masonic charities, but he also understood the complexities of social care. Here, an anecdote offers a good insight into his philosophy. As chairman for the Province of South Wales 2021 RMBI Festival, he set a target of raising £5 million by November 2021. My vice chairman thought that was an awful lot, but I said that first you need to set a stretching target, and second, it's just like a change management program, he says. He looked at me, wondering where on earth I was coming from. But what I meant is that you need an objective worth going for, and then you need people to believe in it and to follow it. That's how you achieve ownership. It helps that we have an RMBI home in our province because you cannot take Freemasons' giving for granted. You need to give them a reason why. So, we engage continually throughout the festival, explaining the wonderful work provided by the RMBI and the MCF. When he was 30, Sir Paul was approached by a couple of doctors. He was always able to bridge the gap between medical and managerial cultures at the NHS, and invited to become a Freemason. He joined Dinam Lodge No. 4521 in Penarth, just outside Cardiff, a lodge with strong medical connections. It was named after Lord David Davies of Llandinam, a Welsh industrialist, politician and philanthropist who founded the Temple of Peace and Health in Cardiff, a building that once housed the Welsh Hospital Board. Freemasonry's core values chimed with Sir Paul's principles, while the degrees and orders gave him further avenues for self-education. Freemasonry became a companion to my approach to learning and development because it gave an insight into oneself, he says. It provided an opportunity to know yourself and emphasized the importance of integrity, listening, empathy, education, doing as much as you can with your life, charity, compassion. Those things I understood intuitively. The values of Freemasonry stand the test of time, and if they are practiced properly, can add value to your life. It gave me an inner strength. That resolve was tested when Sir Paul's Masonic connections became front-page news in the Welsh press, just as he prepared to become chief executive of NHS Wales. It was a stomach-churning moment, but one that ultimately worked in his favour, as Sir Paul received the full backing of his peers. It was the best thing that happened to me because it meant I was outed and it didn't have the effect on my career they wanted, he says. It's a career that seems to find a natural fruition at the MCF. Here, his years in public service, his love of charity and Freemasonry, and his skills in management, administration and leadership come together for the benefit of a great cause and venerable institution. I feel honoured at being given this opportunity, he says. There are 300 years of heritage, and to be in a position to have some influence in an organisation with that tradition, well, it's quite humbling and brings great responsibilities. We have to make sure that money is spent wisely and effectively, while looking after the reputation of the organisation, and we are continually horizon scanning to see where we fit into the charity sector. People still don't understand how much Freemasons contribute, but we want to be recognised as a genuine force for good.
Now we begin the short section, Daily Enhancement. And we have two articles. First, how the Museum of Freemasonry is digitising its collection. And second, Dr. Rick Berman on Philip, Duke of Wharton's downfall. So let's start with the first of those articles, Digitising the Past for the Future. Museum of Freemasonry has partnered with Google to put its exhibits on a global stage. Marketing and communications manager Barry Hughes tells us more. It's no secret, and certainly no surprise, that Museum of Freemasonry has had to implement its digital strategy at a much greater speed than initially anticipated due to the pandemic. Like many small cultural organisations up and down the country, we found ourselves burdened with a higher degree of pressure to deliver digital content in order to continue under unusual circumstances. If there was a positive to come from the lockdowns, it would be that we are now better equipped for a digital future. A huge amount of work was carried out by the museum to recognise and account for the changes that would be necessary in delivering a museum fit for the 21st century. With the groundwork prepared and a clear path approved, we have started the digital integration needed to ensure both the collection and you are well served. Some steps had already been taken, so we certainly weren't starting from scratch. With wonderful resources such as Masonic Periodicals Online, Lane's Masonic Records, Art UK and others that you can find through our website for free, we have a good pool of digital tools to refer back to. As our exhibitions and projects sourced from the museum, library or archival collections continued to grow, we will no doubt add more bespoke online resources over the coming years too. As a registered charity, the museum relies on the generosity of friends and supporters, from individuals to Grand Lodge. Even charity has become digital now. Not only can donations be made via the website or in the museum itself using contactless payments, another new development is the museum enrolling in Google for non-profits. This initiative opens doors for the museum in terms of having access to powerful online tools and software, as well as providing a crucial digital advertising bursary. By enrolling with Google for Nonprofits, we've also become an official partner of the Google Cultural Institute, which means we have a presence on the Google Arts and Culture platform. This provides an online space for museums and galleries to showcase their collections for free, while taking advantage of the search engine's giant reach. It means we can create a virtual museum that can be easily found and visited by a global audience, creating a road back to our home in Freemasons Hall, London. The museum's first exhibition on arts and culture is a re-presentation of 2018's exhibition Bejewelled. If you remember, Bejewelled, Badges, Brotherhood and Identity focused on jewels and was received with great interest from press as far away as Mexico and Singapore. While I worked with our curator, Mark Dennis, and collections manager, Emma Roberts, to retain and return as much of the original content as possible for the new digital offer, there were clearly some different approaches needed given the limitations and capabilities of the web space. Once we agreed to the new format, I photographed everything in high resolution so visitors to the online exhibition can zoom in with incredible detail. This meant photographing and cataloguing more than 100 items before editing them for upload to the platform. Once the items were uploaded, there was the process of creating what Google calls stories or mini-exhibits in their own right. For example, the first is called Striking Design and explores the process of a lodge deciding on a badge design, creating the artwork and having the piece made. Toy, Kenning and Spencer has loaned examples of each step of the process, from the sheet metal to the blank created using a steel die to strike the metal plate, to the various stages of polishing and enamelling before the final jewel appears. The following four stories then represent the many other aspects of jewels, from significance to utility, with items from around the world. Having begun the process to join the Google Cultural Institute in April 2020, we finally had our launch in June 2021. The end result is an exhibition we can be proud of for its rich visual content, detail and the clarity in describing an important tradition of Freemasonry. It has been a fascinating process and a valuable experience. Not only do we now have another online space for the museum to show off its unique collection and its stories, but this digital space comes with the backing of the internet's largest search engine. The value is immeasurable. It builds upon the museum's digital future and shares the history of Freemasonry with a global audience through engaging stories. And you can look for Museum of Freemasonry on Google Arts and Culture at www.artsandculture.google.com.
On page 38, Fall from Grace. Did the young Philip, Duke of Wharton, succeed or usurp John, Duke of Montague, as Grand Master? Dr. Rick Berman investigates. The frontispiece of the 1723 Constitutions is designed to impress. John, Duke of Montague, wearing the robes of the Order of the Garter, presents a constitutional scroll and compasses to his successor Philip, Duke of Wharton. Each man is supported by his deputy Grand Master and Grand Wardens, with a colonnade of pillars showing the five orders of architecture framing the transfer of Masonic authority. But the picture of a seamless transition was a probable fiction. Wharton had been made a Freemason at the age of 22, a few months after Montague's installation as Grand Master. As Appleby's original weekly journal noted on the 5th of August 1721, the ceremonies being performed at the King's Arms Tavern, His Grace came home to his house in the Pall Mall in a white leathern apron. Philip had been rebellious as a youth, and his mercurial nature persisted into adulthood. Indeed, he was the opposite to his staid father Thomas, who had been a privy councillor, comptroller of the royal household, Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, Lord Lieutenant of Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire, and Lord Privy Seal. When Wharton inherited in 1715, he gained a vast financial inheritance, 6 titles in the English and Irish peerage, and impeccable political connections. But he rebelled nonetheless. A grand tour in 1716 was abandoned, and Wharton travelled instead to France to visit the pretender, James Stuart, at Avignon, who invested him Duke of Northumberland. This was potentially treasonable and could have been disastrous, but was overlooked and regarded as a youthful misdemeanour. After all, Wharton was only 17. On his return, he was allowed to sit in the Irish Parliament, sworn a privy councillor, and in January 1718 was created Duke of Wharton. Wharton took his seat in the House of Lords in December 1719 at the age of 21. He seemed to have mellowed, and his speeches were generally pro-government, encouraging a belief that the dukedom had ensured his loyalty. But this was soon proved wrong. Wharton's politics were driven by self-interest. He launched an effective attack on the government's handling of the South Sea Company crisis, condemning it as dangerous bait which might decoy unwary people to their ruin. The words were accurate but not altruistic. Wharton had speculated and lost some £120,000, the equivalent of millions today. In his 1738 Constitutions, James Anderson suggests that Wharton usurped rather than succeeded Montague as Grand Master, either to commandeer what was a potentially influential organisation or simply to cause a nuisance, writing, "Philip, Duke of Wharton, lately made a brother, though not the master of a lodge, being ambitious of the chair, got a number of others to meet him at Stationers' Hall, 24th of June, 1722. And having no grand officers, they put in the chair the oldest master mason, and without the usual decent ceremonials, the said oldest mason proclaimed aloud Philip, Duke of Wharton, Grand Master of Masons, but his grace appointed no deputy, nor was the lodge opened and closed in due form. Therefore the noble brothers, and all those that would not countenance irregularities, disowned Wharton's authority, till worthy brother Montague healed the breach of harmony, by summoning the Grand Lodge to meet 17th of January, 1723, at the King's Arms aforesaid, where the Duke of Wharton, promising to be true and faithful, Deputy Grand Master Beale proclaimed aloud the most noble prince, and our brother Philip Duke of Wharton, Grand Master of Masons, who appointed Dr. Desaguliers the Deputy Grand Master, and Joshua Timson and James Anderson, Grand Wardens." However, notwithstanding Anderson's one-sided record, Wharton was accepted as Grand Master, and many Freemasons attended the Grand Feast held on the 25th of June to mark his installation. The event was reported in the London Journal and other newspapers, which said that membership of the Freemasons was some 4,000, an astonishing achievement if accurate. Nonetheless, Wharton's anti-Hanoverian display in the House of Lords in defence of Francis Atterbury, the Bishop of Rochester, against a charge of treason and his support for Jacobitism, was not an image that many in Grand Lodge wished to be associated with. Wharton had waived his right to name a successor Grand Master, possibly in the conviction that his friends might move his re-election. But rather than re-elect Wharton, Grand Lodge chose the Earl of Dalkeith, who named Desaguliers as his deputy. Wharton's attempt to control English Freemasonry prompted Desaguliers to instigate changes, including the passage of a resolution in Grand Lodge that it was not in the power of any body of men to make any alteration or innovation in the body of Masonry without the consent first obtained of Grand Lodge. A later resolution agreed that the Grand Master at installation shall nominate and appoint his Deputy Grand Master, an important ruling since the Deputy Grand Master exercised authority in the name of the Grand Master. Within a few years, Wharton's profligacy forced him to sell his assets and seek relief for his debts. But his pro-Jacobite politics and dissolute life afforded him little support. He left England in June 1725 and, after a short period in Paris, travelled to Madrid, where he enlisted in the Spanish army and appeared against the British at Gibraltar. Despite this, Wharton signed a petition to Grand Lodge in 1728 to warrant a lodge in Madrid. This was granted, and the lodge was established by Charles Le Bellier, one of Desaguliers' acolytes, who became its first master. Given his reduced circumstances, Wharton's continuing interest in Freemasonry is understandable, since its reputation in Europe offered prestige. Moreover, Wharton, still a duke, may have hoped to regain political favour with London. If so, he failed. He was outlawed by Parliament on the 3rd of April 1729 for failing to answer a charge of treason, and his titles and property were declared forfeit. He died a pauper at the Cistercian monastery at Poblet in Catalonia, just 2 years later in 1731. He was 33.
The next section is The Royal Arch, Thoughts from the Supreme Grand Chapter. And it's a single article called Strength in Unity. Prestonian lecturer Tony Harvey looks at the historic links between the core degrees in Freemasonry, Craft, the Royal Arch and the Mark. Judging by exchanges on social media and elsewhere, many of us seem to be confused about the relationship between what are arguably the core degrees in Freemasonry, the Craft, Royal Arch, and the Mark. In England and Wales, the relationship between them hinges on the Act of Union of 1813, the instrument that formed the United Grand Lodge of England. The second article states, "It is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of three degrees, and no more, viz. Those of the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master mason, including the supreme order of the Holy Royal Arch." This statement established an indissoluble link between the craft and the Royal Arch, and included the latter in something. However, reading it today, the exact nature of that link remains ambiguous. Furthermore, this statement made no mention of the mark, effectively omitting it from this special relationship. To complicate matters, between 1874 and 2004, the Royal Arch ritual described itself as the completion of the Master Mason's degree. Yet both ceremonies have all the well-known features of a complete degree: the admission, blessing, proving or testing, the obligation, entrusting with secrets, an explanation of the traditional history and moral lessons, and the investiture of the new entrant. What more can we expect from any degree? The third degree is clearly complete in itself. Harry Carr, Cyril Batham and Roy Wells, three distinguished Royal Arch researchers, were of this opinion. Suggesting otherwise is potentially frustrating to any newly raised brother who would be justified in feeling cheated if described as being incomplete. In 1843, the editor of the Freemasons Quarterly Review suggested the entire system requires careful re-examination. In 2003, UGLE and Supreme Grand Chapter did just that, and the Royal Arch is no longer described as the completion of the third degree, as the claim was removed from the ritual in 2004. Today, we describe the Royal Arch as the completion of the journey begun with initiation. According to Article 2, it is therefore pure ancient masonry, that the Royal Arch is included within and which it completes, not the third degree. This position is fully supported by an examination of the physical Act of Union, which reveals key parts of the critical sentence were clearly amended at the last minute. The acclaimed Royal Arch historian, the late Douglas Burford, claimed in his 1993 Batham lecture that when it was signed, the document actually read, "It is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of four degrees and no more, viz. Those of the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, the master mason, and also the supreme degree of the Holy Royal Arch." This description is much clearer and quite logical, but it was unacceptable to the moderns, who had a very firm view about the status of the Royal Arch. To understand this, we have to track the early years of organised Freemasonry from the foundation of the Premier Grand Lodge in 1717. Originally, the craft comprised only the first and second degrees. The Master Mason's degree only developed in the 1720s. The first reference to a Royal Arch came in Ireland 20 years later. However, that reference does not mention a degree ceremony. The earliest record of a Royal Arch degree itself in England was when Thomas Dunkley was made a Royal Arch Mason in Portsmouth in 1754. That's some 30 years after the Master Mason's degree emerged. Therefore, if the Master Mason's degree was designed to be incomplete, an early Master Mason would have had to have waited at least 30 years for the concluding part, an idea that was clearly absurd. It was Dr. Oliver who suggested the Royal Arch was created by removing part of the third degree, though 18th century rituals do not support this claim. In Pritchard's 1730 exposé, the earliest text we have of the three craft degrees, there is no mention of anything to be subsequently found in the Royal Arch. But what about the mark degrees? The first record of a mark ceremony in England dates to 1769, when the same Thomas Dunkerley conferred the degree of Mark Man and Mark Master on six Royal Arch companions. So, over 50 years, between 1720 and 1769, there developed what have since become the major elements of today's speculative Freemasonry. However, in 1751, a rival Grand Lodge was formed. Its second Grand Secretary, Lawrence Dermot, nicknamed this Grand Lodge the Ancients, claiming it practised Freemasonry free from innovation. From then on, the Premier Grand Lodge was known colloquially as the Moderns. Unfortunately, these two Grand Lodges had very different views on the Mark and the Royal Arch. Ironically, given their recent creation, the Ancients considered both the Mark and the Royal Arch to be part of ancient Freemasonry and authorised subordinate craft lodges to work the degrees. By contrast, the Moderns allowed only the three craft degrees to be conferred in its lodges. However, in 1766, some Freemasons from the Moderns formed the excellent Grand and Royal Chapter of the Royal Arch of Jerusalem to regulate the Royal Arch separate from the craft. The union of these two Grand Lodges in 1813 therefore required a compromise, the Sussex Fudge, as Jim Daniel calls it. Neither the Moderns nor the Ancients could lose face. To satisfy the Moderns, reference had to be made to three degrees and no more, whilst the Royal Arch, if it was to be included at all, had to be kept separate from the craft degrees. However, to satisfy the Ancients, the Royal Arch simply had to be included. The eventual wording of the Declaration therefore became the compromise that defines English Freemasonry to this very day. No other jurisdiction anywhere in the world has anything similar to this curious relationship. So how might the Declaration be worded using today's punctuation and without the sensitivities that divided the Ancients and the Moderns? This is one attempt. It is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of the three degrees of the craft, namely entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason, governed by United Grand Lodge of England, and that of the Royal Arch, governed by Supreme Grand Chapter. In 1817, the Royal Arch was put under a new governing body. What eventually was called Supreme Grand Chapter was, and remains, led by the same principal officers who govern the United Grand Lodge, thereby preserving the indissoluble link between them. The Craft and Royal Arch are therefore two orders, but are essentially the same organisation. They're like two sides of the same coin, or two brands. But what happened to the Mark? It was completely omitted from the new system created by the Union in 1813. To include it would likely have pushed that compromise too far. Instead, the mark continued to be worked by lodges under the radar. However, this could not continue for long. After a Scottish Royal Arch chapter issued a charter for an English mark lodge against the regulations of its own grand chapter, a means had to be found to regularise the mark. Therefore, in 1856, a new Grand Lodge of Mark Master Masons was formed to govern the degree. As a consequence of this curious evolution, while the Craft and Royal Arch are linked as two parts of the same organisation, both are separate from the Mark, which has its own independent and sovereign governing body. This situation is therefore very different to what's found in Ireland and Scotland. Neither have an indissoluble link between the Craft and the Royal Arch. Their Supreme Grand Royal Arch chapters are completely separate from their Craft Grand Lodges. In both jurisdictions, their grand chapters govern the mark, which is taken by Master Masons as a qualifying degree before exaltation. However, in Scotland, the Grand Chapter has granted craft lodges permission to work the mark, provided it's only conferred on Master Masons. The current situation in English Freemasonry is therefore very different to that found at the end of the 18th century, when the craft, royal arch and mark were all part of one common system. At that time, the narratives of these degrees were interlinked, and there were many thematic and symbolic connections between them. Since the Union, however, there have been many changes to our rituals, ceremonies and governance. Elements of this one common system have been moved and removed, yet each degree still contains fragments of the complete story. It's as if we've broken up a jigsaw, resulting in holes and gaps that have, in some cases, been filled by misunderstanding and confusion. However, there is no need to tell the story sequentially. Just as film scripts do not always tell a story chronologically, it doesn't matter whether we take these degrees in the sequence of the original narrative. What matters most is the purpose behind the story and our individual journey. It's only when you piece together the craft, royal arch and mark that you realise they are all part of the same system, and that, when considered together, they lead to a fuller understanding of that system. We now begin the Grand Lodge section, news from Great Queen Street, and there are three articles in this section. First, the Pro Grand Master looks forward to better times ahead. Second, your strategy for how to plan, attract, engage and retrieve. And thirdly, fraternal partnership, Monmouthshire and Madras on sharing Solomon learnings.
On page 48, we shall meet again. In his July message, Pro Grand Master Peter Lowndes paid his respects to those we have lost in the pandemic and looked forward to better times ahead. Brethren, today feels like a new beginning, and I hope you will agree that it was appropriate to include in our meeting a memorial to all those who have been lost to us over the past 18 months or so. Too many will have left a huge hole in their families and will be much missed by their friends and lodgers. We owe it to them to make certain that we now put all our efforts into ensuring a bright future for all. I would again like to thank the Grand Chaplain and all those who contributed to a most suitable tribute. It is almost inevitable when the world, this country and our organisation have been so badly hit by something largely beyond our control that some people will add to the gloom and consider that nothing will ever get back to how it was before. I am one of those who suspect that what we have always considered normal is a longish way off, but that does not mean, brethren, that there are not good times around the corner, and, hopefully, not too long or steep a corner. If there are changes to many of our lives, and there almost certainly will be, that does not necessitate life being worse, very much to the contrary, and it is up to all of us to ensure that initially we return to the status quo. I want to emphasize the word initially, as our expectation should and must be to go beyond the status quo, and by some margin. So much has happened over our closed period that I really believe we can benefit from. Importantly, there also appear to be high-quality candidates and from all walks of life. All the surveys that have been carried out to determine how we are viewed by the public have had a positive result compared with the previous survey 2 years ago, which, in itself, was reasonably positive. That must surely mean that we are getting something right, and, in my view, a great deal right. We have talked very openly about all the fantastic work that has been done during the lockdowns, and, importantly, we have ensured that the press is aware of what has gone on and how much our members have been involved in their communities. As a result, there has been much more positive comment and, conversely, much less that is negative. I am not going to pretend that the days of Freemasonry being used for cheap shots in TV dramas or being blamed for all the ills in society are gone. They are not. But they are reduced and will reduce further the better we get at explaining what we stand for. I would like to think that, as a result of the many initiatives such as, but by no means only, First Rising, as well as the considerable efforts of the communications teams, both nationally and locally, the public perception of Freemasonry has improved immeasurably, and certainly beyond anything I can recall from the past. The production, for the first time, of our annual report has also been an enormous step forward in this respect. We must and will ensure that this continues to be the case. Beyond this, it is evident that our internal communications from the centre to the provinces and districts, from our provinces and districts to their lodges, and our lodges to their members, has also taken a giant step forward, which can only be a tremendous boost for the future. All the evidence that I have seen points to a large number of candidates waiting in the wings. They have waited long enough, and we must do all we can to ensure that they are admitted to our lodges as soon as is practical. What proves to be practical will vary from lodge to lodge. I would encourage them to consider multiple ceremonies, although, if a lodge is averse to the idea, this must be respected. Indeed, traditions should also be respected, but if for the good of the lodge a temporary relaxation of that tradition would be beneficial, consideration should be given to that. It may well be, brethren, that the tradition concerned is not as long-standing as some would like to think. It seems to me that many lodges all across our constitution are gearing themselves up for a fast start once official guidelines allow meetings to take place in relative normality. This is encouraging, and I can't emphasize strongly enough the importance of ensuring that all lodges embrace this aspect and provide the best possible experience for their members, most particularly their candidates. I have heard many stories of lodges preparing for emergency meetings to try and catch up on all the deferred ceremonies, and dispensations for this purpose will not be charged for. Indeed, in this building alone, I understand that space is at a premium during the usually quiet month of August. I, personally, am looking forward enormously to seeing ceremonies performed as they were intended, and no doubt, brethren, the ritual will be nearly perfect considering all the time those concerned have had to learn it during lockdown. I didn't have time to learn it all will surely be a pretty lame excuse in the short term, at least. The Royal Arch has suffered almost more than the craft during the lockdown periods, and what a joy it will be to be able to witness again the exaltation ceremony, surely one of the most impressive ceremonies in masonry. What a good time it will be to encourage all non-Royal Arch Masons to seriously consider joining an order that they cannot fail to enjoy. Brethren, during the last year there has been a fortnightly Zoom meeting of European Grand Masters, and I have attended many of them. A year ago there was optimism among some that normality was just around the corner. We were not of that view, and sadly that proved correct. I think it is fair to say that the situation in European Freemasonry is rather more problematic than here. That should not lead to complacency, and we must continue to carefully follow all government guidelines as they are laid down and updated. We must also show consideration and understanding towards those brethren who are reluctant to venture forth to meetings for the time being. They will have reasons, and we must keep in touch with them and keep them informed of all that is going on in our lodges. Brethren, one of many things that UGLE is good at is celebrating important milestones. There have been many, many instances of this over the years, recently culminating in our tercentenary celebrations in 2017. In 2023, we have another very significant event to acknowledge and enjoy, as it was in 1723 that the then Grand Lodge of London and Westminster, founded only 6 years before, published and distributed what are sometimes referred to as the Anderson Constitutions. This document gave the world the ancient charges, which were an astonishingly bold, almost revolutionary proclamation of values for the young Grand Lodge, and which, incidentally, are still the same and quoted in our lodges today. And it also gave a set of organizational principles and rules about how a lodge, and by extension any secular society or group of individuals, should conduct itself. We shall celebrate the fact that, starting with the promulgation of the constitutions, Freemasonry became an important vector for the principles of the European Enlightenment, confidently propagating notions of religious tolerance, meritocracy, self-improvement by education, and even democratic elections. These ideas, new in their day, spread to and were enthusiastically embraced by countries on the continent of Europe and by our then colonies in America, shaping governance models at every level. 2023 is, therefore, a most important anniversary, and our own excitement about the power of the message, Freemasonry, inventing the future, is shared by Grand Lodges around the world. Our own celebrations will begin with a special meeting of Grand Lodge, to be held on the 31st of January 2023, and to which we shall invite overseas Grand Lodges. Seminars and conferences are currently scheduled to take place in Cambridge, Paris, and at the George Washington Masonic National Memorial in Virginia during the course of 2023. In the months ahead, we shall also be drawing your attention to a dedicated 2023 website and, in due course, a dedicated museum exhibition. Brethren, we have something to proclaim and be proud of. Our own members and the wider world will notice. I have said before that now is a good time to be a Freemason. Of course, it is always a good time to be a Freemason, but, I suggest, none better than now. We have proved during the last impossibly difficult 18 months what an incredibly resilient organization we are, and how wonderfully versatile we are when it comes to helping others, whether they are Freemasons or not. We now, going forward, have the best opportunity we could wish for to bring our brilliant institution back to its former glory. We may not reach the numbers of previous generations, but I am sure we will, and to an extent already have, restore our reputation in society to where it was and most certainly deserves to be. Brethren, let us go forth and multiply.
The second article in the Grand Lodge section is entitled The Member's Pathway. It starts on page 50, Attracting Members, Growing Lodges. Plan, attract, engage and retrieve are watchwords coined by the Pathway Working Party to form a framework for bolstering both current meetings and future membership. And here is how your lodge can benefit. Membership remains at the heart of UGLE's strategic thinking, and so I am immensely pleased to have been asked to introduce this updated members' pathway to you. And this is Brother Peter G. Lowndes, Pro GM. And this article is written by M.W. Brother Peter G. Lowndes, Pro GM. Membership remains at the heart of UGLE's strategic thinking, and so I am immensely pleased to have been asked to introduce this updated members' pathway to you. The members' pathway was launched in 2017, and a significant review was undertaken by the Pathway Working Party in 2019. Valuable lessons were learned from the lodges that had adopted the original version, and this led to a project to revamp it, to incorporate those lessons and assist us all to achieve our aim of first stabilising and then increasing our membership. Plan, attract, engage and retrieve are our new watchwords to help ensure our meetings are enjoyed by all, losses are stemmed and our membership grows. I'm extremely impressed with the updated version of the members pathway. It will be of enormous value to all lodges across the constitution, whether they be in Metropolitan Grand Lodge, the provinces or our districts. The initial rollout will be to lodges through Metropolitan Grand Lodge and Provincial Grand Lodges. This will be followed by a project to support districts. I encourage you to read this article, consider and study the attached leaflet, work with your lodge membership team, who will be supported by the provincial teams, including the provincial pathway officers, and let's all start to make our hopes and ambitions realities. And now the second part of the article is written by Nick Wilson, Provincial Grand Lodge of Cumberland and Westmorland, and RCG1, the North Rep, and Chris Hurst, Metropolitan Grand Lodge Rep and Pathway Project Manager. What is the Members' Pathway? The Members' Pathway provides an overall framework that will help lodges to plan lodge and membership development, attract and welcome new members, engage with new and existing members to reduce losses, and retrieve, find ways to encourage those who have drifted away to rekindle their interest. The aim is to assist all lodges to become vibrant and so enjoyable that everyone looks forward to attending the next meeting. The members' pathway is now presented in a cyclical format to emphasise that it's a continuous process, but with greater focus on planning and engagement. There are three levels of information. The leaflet attached to this article, quick start guides provided in hard copy format as well as click and view online, and detailed guidance which is click and view online only. The leaflet gives an overview of the hub, the core of the member's pathway, elements, the individual parts, and threads, brief descriptions of the content of each element. The hub contains the four main areas of membership activity: plan, attract, engage, and retrieve. Each of these areas is broken down into elements and then further expanded into threads. It's presented in this format to direct the user to the specific support materials they need. The attached leaflet provides more information and context. The quick start guides provide further detail and, in the digital version, will include links to the in-depth guidance available to support members and lodges. The b.ugle.org.uk membership site will provide the repository for the members' pathway materials. Much of this material is drawn from the original version of the members' pathway, but is now accessed in a more intuitive manner. Why is the members' pathway important? This updated version contains good practices from the original members' pathway. Practical ideas have been drawn from the success of lodges in engaging members, planning meetings so that they're enjoyed by everyone and contribute to the stemming losses, and growing our membership. It should be the catalyst to help develop our lodges and re-engage our membership, capitalising on the recent PR successes that have followed the incredible community support provided by Freemasons during the pandemic. It will champion our values of integrity, friendship, respect and charity. In recent weeks, an introductory document referred to as Prepping for Pathway was made available to all members through First Rising. This used a metaphor of baking a cake to help provincial and lodge teams consider how they plan, attract, engage and retrieve members, as well as introducing the role of the lodge membership officer. This was well received, and from the positive feedback from the recent presentations given to the provincial Grand Masters and their provincial teams, the working party are confident that the updated members' pathway will be equally welcomed and supported. The concepts and information included in the Prepping for Pathway document can be found in the Plan and Engage sections of the Hub. Who is involved? The success of the members' pathway relies on a willingness of lodges and members to embrace change, the active involvement of the lodge membership team, membership officer, mentor, almoner and secretary, amongst others, to inspire and motivate lodge members, and the support the members of the lodge give them. Not every lodge will be able to appoint individual membership officers and mentors, but it will be critical for someone to be identified to carry out these roles. Every member, from the newest to the most experienced, should have an opportunity to contribute to lodge and membership development, see Hub Plan section, Element Lodge Planning. A willingness to embrace change in order to inspire and motivate lodge members is a prerequisite for success. Provincial and Metropolitan Grand Lodges will be looking to implement the updated members' pathway over the next few weeks to a schedule set by their executive teams against local priorities. Guidance and briefings will be shared with the provincial pathway officers, the team responsible for local delivery and implementation. These materials, having been customised to suit the local needs, will be used to update lodges and members. The members' pathway is a resource you can use to help secure the future of your lodge, so that together we can be attracting members and growing lodges for years to come.
On page 54. From Monmouthshire to Madras. After implementing aspects of Solomon, the province of Monmouthshire shared its expertise with the district of Madras. It was the beginning of a productive partnership. On the 16th of November, the Learning and Development team will be hosting the International Learning and Development Forum. This is an opportunity for learning and development leads from across the globe to meet virtually and discuss best practice and initiatives across their metropolitan areas, provinces, districts and groups. Before the launch of the Solomon platform more than 2 years ago, the Improvement Development Group had given considerable thought to the best ways of advancing the initiative as an effective learning repository. They identified that a key requirement to achieving this was to encourage provinces and districts to work together in a collaborative and supportive way. This was the mantra that was recognised as a feature of the annual Learning and Development Conferences, and has been an ethos that the Learning and Development team has continued to promote by encouraging communication between the L&D leads. At the 2020 Learning and Development Conference, Graham Murphy, Learning and Development Lead for Monmouthshire, presented a case study that highlighted the way that his province had introduced and implemented aspects of Solomon. Delegates were again encouraged to work together in order to disseminate best practice through sharing ideas, strategies, and expertise. Duleep Sardavan, the lead for the District of Madras, was particularly interested with the successes enjoyed by Monmouthshire. On the advice of William Halsey, Solomon manager and one of the conference organisers, contact was made between Madras and Monmouthshire that resulted in a number of virtual meetings and the start of a productive fraternal partnership. Both Duleep and Graham respectively provided context on the strengths and characteristics of their district and province. First, Graham outlined the process for developing successful strategies for learning and development within Monmouthshire. These included gaining commitment from the provincial grandmaster and the executive, letters and emails being sent to all lodge secretaries and scribes E outlining the purpose, benefits, and the ways of using Solomon. Solomon being presented at both the Provincial Lodge of Installed Masters and the First Principles chapters. Launch events for introducing the scheme. An invitation to all lodges and chapters, providing them with opportunities to observe ways of presenting nuggets and papers. The provision of shadowing opportunities for interested brethren. A discussion of the values of presenting nuggets or papers at election meetings. The way nuggets were used at installation meetings. A nugget being included within each provincial monthly newsletter, guaranteeing full exposure of the platform to all members. A formative report on learning and development activities included in each newsletter. An annual summary report being sent to all members of the province so that they are fully aware of learning and development opportunities. Zoom meetings including Solomon materials at both lodge and provincial events. Duleep identified that learning and development was a key focus for members within the District of Madras. He also identified that an immediate focus was on recognising and encouraging presenters with excellent communication skills and on defining key roles to support their plan. He also wished to enhance a joint craft and royal arch approach. As a consequence, an electronic copy of the Monmouthshire Progress Action Plan was shared with Madras with the approval of Richard Davies, Provincial Grand Master for Monmouthshire, and Theophilus Devanyanam, District Grand Master for Madras. The speed of the evolution of Solomon within Madras has been remarkable. In just 2 months, it had launched the scheme and held 4 webinar conferences. Attendance at each has been exceptionally high. The first one attracted 148 delegates and was so popular that there was a demand to repeat the conference with a further 68. So far, 34 different nuggets have been presented by 34 different brethren at Solomon Lodge familiarisation events. The commitment of the District Grand Master in the development of the platform within Madras is evident in his presentations and presence at the conferences. At all of these, Duleep has ensured that the voices and exuberance of younger members has been a feature throughout. Each of the presenters delivered their materials in a manner that would captivate, motivate, and enthuse any audience. In George Jacob, Madras has someone who is capable of navigating even the most reticent person through Solomon. His use of IT to enhance his presentations leaves his audience with a clear visual picture, instilling confidence in them to explore further. The future for the District of Madras looks bright. It has held workshops entitled the Champions Forum, which are hosted by active district champions and attended by members from its own district and the learning and development team from Monmouthshire. It has also identified a time frame and vision for the involvement of its members, and has set out the way it is going to advocate the relevance of continued learning. It has identified the conjoined strategy between the Royal Arch and the craft. Importantly, it has set out the metrics that it believes will identify the success of its planning. Already, rollout agendas have been planned for each lodge and chapter within the district in order to develop Solomon further. To support this, the province has identified a calendar of training for its Solomon leads and champions. The benefits of continued collaboration have also been identified. Interestingly, the fraternal partnership came about through an outreach from Madras to Monmouthshire arranged through UGLE. The benefits to Monmouthshire have been immense. Members from the province had been invited to participate in the Madras conferences. As part of the continued evaluations of the Madras Action Plan, areas for further development within Monmouthshire have also been highlighted. This partnership has been very real and effective in bringing about tangible outcomes. The sharing of ideas that was initially based upon learning and development has since expanded to other areas between the province and the district, with the provincial and district grand directors of ceremonies now conferencing and sharing ideas on best practice. 2 years ago, UGLE had a clear vision, advocating that provinces and districts should work together in a collaborative and supportive way. Madras and Monmouthshire have followed this advice and capitalised on this strategy with unequivocal success. It goes to show that despite being more than 9,000 miles apart, distance is no barrier to uniting learning and development and Freemasonry. Long may it continue. Accompanying this piece are six portraits of attendees of Zoom meetings. The attendees shown are Richard Davies, Duleep Sardavan, Graham Murphy, David Llewellyn, Jonathan Roberts, and Nigel Bevan.
This next section is the culture and book reviews section, and it also contains a crossword at the end. The four book reviews this time are Freemasonry, A Progressive Science by Raymond W. Hudson, Freemasonry on the Frontier by various authors, Who Was Hiram Abiff by J.S.M. Ward, and The Masonic Tutors Handbooks Volume 2, Freemasonry After COVID-19 by Robert Lomas. So we start with Freemasonry, A Progressive Science by Raymond W. Hudson. And the review is by Andrew Pippin. And he writes, have you ever wondered why there are so many side orders in Freemasonry? Have you wondered where they came from? Wanted to explore them but didn't know quite what to do next? In other words, how does anyone explore beyond the craft and choose a path that's right for them? Asking someone you already know who belongs to other orders can be a bit hit and miss. Even though they might be enthusiastic about their membership and explain clearly what it involves, they may only really know about the side order or orders that they belong to. On the other hand, maps of side orders can easily be found online but can sometimes be rather confusing, almost like complicated family trees. This compact and easy-to-navigate book aims to get around such difficulties by providing a concise account of some 30-plus orders. It includes potted histories, as well as a brief look at the ceremonies and the philosophies behind them. Together, the Masonic family tree begins to make sense. However, despite all the basic information being in one place, it's not a book best read in one go. It's better tackled chapter by chapter, each being a short nugget of information to be digested on its own. If read in one sitting by someone who knew very little, they might possibly find themselves forgetting how many chapters they'd read, with the details of the orders blurring into a kind of giant Masonic superorder. In reality, this just means some rereading. That said, Freemasonry, A Progressive Science, is an ideal and accurate primer for anyone interested in the fascinating orders that exist beyond the craft, whether an experienced Freemason or not.
A review of Freemasonry on the Frontier by various authors. A grand collection. Excellent papers from first-rate scholars. In between COVID lockdowns, Freemasons from the UK crossed the Atlantic to the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts to hold a symposium. That learned body was addressed by the foremost academic Freemasons of our times. This was the 2020 conference held by Quatuor Coronati Lodge. Lewis Masonic has now reproduced the papers at the heart of the symposium in a handsome volume called Freemasonry on the Frontier. Freemasonry welcomes good men from every background. Likewise, books written by Freemasons about Freemasons will vary. This collection of 17 academic papers might seem outside the general run, but I urge you to pause before concluding that it is not for you. As well as distinguished American Masonic speakers, Quatuor Coronati fielded a stellar cast to bear its colours and present fascinating papers. Dr. Rick Berman and Dr. Andreas Unnerfors are names at the forefront of British Masonic research, the former being Prestonian lecturer in 2016, and the latter being director of the Centre for Research into Freemasonry and Fraternalism at the University of Sheffield from 2007 to 2010. Perhaps less widely known, but just as distinguished, is Dr. John Wade, Prestonian lecturer in 2009, who presented his paper about Scottish transatlantic Masonic medical links and has edited this volume. They were joined by other Masonic historical academic experts from the USA, speaking on a wide range of intriguing subjects. The collection is more than 400 pages, bristling with footnotes and academic rigour, but all leavened by excellent writing and startling insight. Our aim is to unite in being happy and communicating happiness. It is also to make a daily advancement in Masonic knowledge. Both aims can be satisfied here in abundance.
And that review was by Stan Hope. And the next book is Who Was Hiram Abiff? By J.S.M. Ward. A strange classic, off the wall, but very much worth reading, reviews Aubrey Buchanan. John Sebastian Marlowe Ward, 1885 to 1949, was a very interesting but decidedly eccentric and sometimes controversial character. A Cambridge history graduate, Ward wrote many learned books about Freemasonry and esotericism. There are, of course, many theories about how Freemasonry originated, ranging from the downright bizarre, for instance, two-headed aliens from space beaming cosmic energy into the pyramids, which is a bit of nonsense I just made up, to the more credible but still unusual ancient vegetation rituals in the Middle East, which I haven't just made up. This book is among the latter. First published in 1927, Who Was Hiram Abiff? Is meticulously written and researched. The book's scope and style were inspired by the then highly influential and eminently readable anthropological masterpiece The Golden Bough by Cambridge scholar Sir James George Frazer. Ward's book delves into antiquity, setting out to show that Freemasonry is the successor of a variety of ancient spiritual and mystic traditions. In its own way, the book is something of a classic and has never been long out of print. Genuinely fascinating, though it may be, attempting to unearth the remote possible origins of Freemasonry can be rather like trying to prove that cricket has its origins in mysterious ancient Babylonian ceremonies. There may be striking parallels, but that doesn't prove that one originated from the other. Moreover, if you are the kind of reader who, to pursue the metaphor, finds playing cricket more important than the history of possible Babylonian ball games, then this book won't be for you. On the other hand, it is well written, carefully researched, and very thought-provoking indeed. Strangely fascinating stuff, even if not a shred of it may be true. I'm going to read it again.
A review of The Masonic Tutor's Handbooks, Volume 2, Freemasonry After COVID-19. By Robert Lomas. After the coronavirus, ideas on dealing with a modern plague. In the author's words, Freemasonry after COVID-19 is intended for Masonic tutors to help lodges recover after the COVID-19 pandemic. As such, it is easily digested in one sitting, being pocket-sized and only 72 pages long. The content is divided into three parts. Part 1 provides an analysis of Freemasonry's status before the pandemic. The author then explains why he believes the pandemic presents an existential threat to Freemasonry, illustrating his argument with various recruitment and membership data over the course of the last century. Part 2 contains advice on how lodges might survive through to the end of the pandemic, while the final section looks at some longer-term strategies for the survival of lodges. The scrutiny of membership data is informative and at times novel in terms of its analytical approach. If the data is accurate, then the existential threat started long before the onset of the pandemic, with the latter merely accelerating the decline. Indeed, this first part of the book is possibly the most interesting section. Part 2 has a sense of having missed the boat if the worst of the pandemic is now behind us, as many lodges will have already initiated the actions suggested. Part 3 is a strange potpourri and doesn't quite match up to its title of Long-Term Strategies to Survive. It is, in part, a lecture on Freemasonry and a list of historically famous Freemasons, set alongside some sketchy and poorly argued suggestions for various lodge mergers, including those of the Royal Arch and Mark, back into the Craft Lodges. I expected greater depth to this section. In summary, although the book has some interesting data and ideas, it is not a concise reference manual, and thus the title of Handbook is perhaps misleading.
And that review was by Robert Jeggs Fowler. Page 65 begins the next section, the charity section, and we have four articles, one called Weathering the Storm, about aid to India in COVID-19 times, one called Freemasons Partner with the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, one called Eight Noughts Reached, and finally in this section, Helping Kids Get Back to School. So we begin with Weathering the Storm. As the Delta variant of COVID-19 decimated India, Freemasons donated £50,000 in aid. Providing for your family is a basic human instinct. The urge to make sure the people you love have the food, water, housing and care they need to thrive is not limited by geographical borders, but a fundamental feeling shared between loved ones globally. That is why headlines and photos showing people in India and southern Sudan struggling to access medical care and nutrition for their families earlier this year have struck such a chord across the world. As a result, the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, stepped in to support those worst affected. In May, densely populated cities in India became ground zero for the outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19. This new wave of the disease swept across the country, decimating healthcare infrastructure and endangering the lives and livelihoods of millions of families. The World Health Organization estimated that India's COVID-19 cases accounted for half the cases in the world. However, thanks to a £50,000 grant from the Freemasons through the MCF, Plan International has been able to support 1,700 of the most vulnerable Indian families with emergency food parcels. Similarly, families in southern Sudan faced an imminent threat to their food supply earlier this year, with heavy flooding destroying homes, crops and even lives. As the UN described the resulting food crisis as the worst on record, the MCF once again partnered with Plan International. On behalf of Freemasonry, the charity gave a £35,000 emergency grant to provide 525 cooking kits to families in Pibor, one of the worst affected regions of the crisis. These emergency grants come as part of the MCF's wider work, providing relief and supporting recovery efforts in the wake of natural disasters, both at home and overseas. Since the MCF's inception in 2016, the charity has provided 44 emergency grants to 24 countries, with a total value of £954,401, and continues to be there to support people all over the world who find themselves in need. You can subscribe to the MCF's mailing list to hear of new emergency grants as well as updates about its work and impact by going to www.mcf.org.uk/FMT/subscribe.
On page 66, Freemasons partner with the Duke of Edinburgh's Award. More than £300,000 raised by Freemasons to help young people with disabilities take part. More than 30,000 young people with disabilities and special educational needs will be able to take part in the Duke of Edinburgh's Award thanks to a grant of £300,000 from Freemasons. Freemasons have become a strategic partner of the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, D of E, funding a new national programme to upskill its team and volunteers. The scheme will also help enrol more schools and clubs to ensure all young people have access to D of E. To make it possible, the United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, and the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, have teamed up to enable the charity to reach at least 30,000 young people with special educational needs and disabilities, SEND, by 2024. The ambition is to increase the number of centres, such as schools and youth groups, offering D of E to young people with SEND, and train hundreds of leaders. These individuals will support groups of young people through their D of E journeys. At least 15,000 young people will achieve a D of E award sponsored by the 200,000-strong UGLE to support the Duke of Edinburgh's award. Fund gets boost by Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Freemasons. The Duke of Edinburgh Memorial Fund received a major donation of £35,000, more than 10% of the total fund, from Isaac Newton University Lodge. The Cambridge-based lodge is primarily for past and present members of Cambridge University, and the donation reflects the 35 years that His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh served as the university's Chancellor. The fund also received a significant contribution of £25,000 from Hertfordshire Freemasons, taking the combined contribution from these two provincial initiatives alone to £60,000. Lodges and individuals can support the Duke of Edinburgh Memorial Fund at mcf.org/uk/fmt/dofe.
8 noughts reached is the third article in this section. We're proud to announce that Freemasons have donated more than £100 million since 2016. The Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, is thrilled to announce that it has given over £100 million in grants on behalf of Freemasonry since its establishment in 2016. This incredible milestone, fully funded by Freemasons, has helped thousands of disadvantaged individuals, families and communities across England, Wales and overseas whose lives have been changed for the better by Freemasonry, said Les Hutchinson, Chief Executive of the MCF. The MCF would like to thank all its dedicated supporters, from volunteers, fundraisers and regular donors, to those who tell others about its work. Every act of help has meant vulnerable and disadvantaged members of our communities are being supported through life's challenges. Thank you. To see how you can help the MCF build better lives on behalf of Freemasonry, visit www.mcf.org.uk/fmt/support.
On page 68, helping kids get back to school. Empowering charities supporting children and young people in their quest for learning. The past 18 months have been tough for everyone, but school-age children have been particularly affected by the turbulence caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Both government and charity reports have stressed that repeated stop-starts in children's face-to-face education have not only chipped away at academic progress, but increased rates of mental ill health caused by social isolation. The COVID-19 crisis has jeopardized the development of many young people, but has come at an even greater cost to students from lower-income families and disadvantaged backgrounds, who have seen the academic attainment gap between themselves and their peers widen dramatically in the past year and a half. However, thanks to the generosity of Freemasons and their families, the Masonic Charitable Foundation has been able to take significant steps towards empowering local and national charities to tackle the problem. Since the pandemic began, the MCF has awarded 84 grants, totalling £2,648,772, to charities supporting children and young people. Many of these focus on mental health and education. With a new academic year just begun, the MCF is continuing to team up with charities all over the UK to help children in their return to formal education. Supported by a £15,000 grant, Quest for Learning in Berkshire is one of the charities assisting children and young people to get the most out of their education during this difficult time. With the MCF's funding, they are able to run literacy and numeracy programs for around 500 vulnerable pupils and help compensate for the disruptions to their learning over the past months. This will support those students who may struggle more when returning to the classroom full time. Other charities are also working hard to ensure children have access to the mental health support they need to feel ready for their first full school year in the classroom. Long periods of social isolation from family members and friends has caused as many as 1 in 4 children to experience a mental health issue. This is a problem that Young Minds, a children's charity that the MCF supported with a grant of £85,000, has said is likely to endure long after the pandemic is over. Young Minds is working hard to break down barriers young people face when accessing mental health support and is equipping schools with the knowledge necessary to support pupils in need. To find out more about the MCF's support for children and young people, as well as their wider impact in your local area, visit mcf.org.uk/fmt/my-community.
And that concludes the charity section. The last item in this audio version is the letters to the editor section. And if you want to write, you write to the editor, FMT, Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ, or email editor@freemasonrytoday.com. And there's one letter been published in this edition of the magazine. This time, it's a poem by Len White, PPSGW, Shiremore Lodge, number 6921, Province of Northumberland, since 1962. And it's a poem, and it's entitled, Where Are Our Masons Now? They fought for king and country in trenches, hand to hand, and bonded with each other in a troubled land. They drowned in stinking shell holes, so tired they couldn't stand, and thousands died in each other's arms or face down on Gallipoli's sands. Called to arms, once more they marched to defend our lands, dying at Dunkirk and in burning North Africa's sands. When the final trumpet sounded, they were welcomed by big bands, but where had their pals all gone to? They just couldn't understand. But they found them all around them, miners, plumbers, deckhands, and even entertainers from local dancing bands. In all the Masonic lodges, they found a helping hand to settle back in Civvy Street. There was such a great demand. The lodges filled up quickly and very soon were crammed, so they opened many more of them all around the land. May we all meet together, was their chorus hand in hand, till we arrived into the 80s when old age took command. The pals were growing old, and some couldn't even stand, so the doors of lodges began to close because of the lack of demand. But the great architect renewed their faith when the next generation made a stand and occupied the vacant chairs left by the faithful band. Long live masonry all across the land. A poem by Len White. And a note at the bottom of the page, the opinions expressed here are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United Grand Lodge of England. All UGLE members' letters printed are appended with the contributor's name, his mother lodge name and number, the town where that lodge meets, and the province. Please include these details at the foot of your letter. Please enclose a stamped addressed envelope for any items sent by mail that you wish to have returned. And that completes the reading of this edition of Freemasonry Today, FMT magazine, issue number 55 for autumn 2021. Thank you for listening.